We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
Top of the morning. This is Deidre K. Alcoholic. What a great day to be sober. My sobriety date is October 3rd, 1997. For that, I'll be forever grateful. I'm 25 years sober. My sponsor is Vanessa W. And my home group is 9604 South Figueroa. So I am so excited to share my story. It is a story of redemption. I started from the bottom, now I'm here. I'm one of those that did not think that coming to AA and telling people my business was going to get me sober. Thank God I was wrong. So let me go back. I come from a wonderful suburb in Los Angeles called South Central. I don't know if anybody has ever heard of it, but I grew up in South Central LA. If you ever watch Boys in the Hood, that's my hood. I grew up in a family of six. It was three boys, three girls. I like to think of us as the Black Brady Bunch. However, we didn't have Alice the maid. We was the maids. And so if you think of the Brady Bunch, I'm Cindy. I'm the baby. And so my mom and dad had these six kids. And what happened was that everyone was stair steps but me. So there's like a 6-year gap between me and the next brother. So I used to get teased as a kid. Oh, mama found you on the doorstep. You really not my sister. You know, they used to tease me about stuff like that. And for me, some kids let stuff like that roll off their back. But I was the type of kid, real sensitive, that I internalized that stuff. I remember begging my mom to show me the birth certificate that I was her child. And the reason that my brothers and sisters said that to me was because I was the tattletale. So my mom and dad used to love to go to Las Vegas for a fun weekend. So they would leave my oldest brothers and sisters in charge. And what happened is that they would no sooner get to the 110 freeway and they would tell my brothers and sisters, don't bring no neighborhood kids in while we're gone. And no sooner had my mom and dad got to the freeway, they were bringing in all the neighborhood kids. And I was the little kid saying, ooh, I'm a tail. And they would lock my little butt up in the closet and they would treat me real bad because I was the tattletale. The other thing was that I have two sisters that are beautiful. They had long, pretty hair, and I didn't. So I used to believe the story that I really wasn't my mama's child. And what happened for me was that one of my first resentments was my sister that's next in age to me. And in Black families, they have like this little banister, and they have all the pictures. So they have my other sister's picture up there, and she's real cute with dimples and she has curly hair, and they got her picture on one end. And then on the other end of the banister is my picture, and I don't have the good hair like my sister. I don't have the little dimples. So they got a bonnet tie real tight around my hair. And so that was my first resentment growing up, was that I didn't have good hair like my sister. And then the next thing, I think I was in about the second or third grade. I broke out with, I think my brother got a dog, and I broke out in eczema, real ugly rash on my neck, the back of my legs and my arms. And I remember I would have all these friends, but in the summertime, when I would break out in this ugly rash, the kids wouldn't play with me no more. They was like, ugh, rashy neck, rashy neck. I'm telling you, I don't like kids today because of that shit, but they wouldn't play with me. And so I had to stay in the house, and my mom put these socks on my hand where I wouldn't scratch myself to death. And what happens when you stay in the house and you can't go outside and play? I read a lot of books. So where other kids were getting the Barbie dream house and they were getting all these baby dolls, I got the whole Nancy Drew series, all 56 books. And I read them from cover to cover. And what happens when you read a lot of books? You get real smart. So I think it was the third grade, they tested me gifted. And what happened with that is that now all of a sudden I'm different again. I didn't know it was a good thing. I just like, oh my God, I'm different. So I skipped from the third to the fifth grade. And now my claim to fame, I'm not pretty like my sisters, but my claim to fame is that I'm smart. So I'm in the gifted program all through school. I go to a special junior high school. And things are going good. You know, I'm smart and I'm gifted. And when I get to high school, I even was homecoming princess. Now, I'm not pretty as all the other girls to me, but I'm funny. I have a quick wit and people like me. So every time, like, I never had a fight in high school, junior high school, never. Because anytime somebody wanted to fight me, by the end of the day, I got them laughing and they're my BFF. So in high school, I was Kenneth Hahn for the day. And in high school, I got a full ride to UC Berkeley at 16. It was six of us that got this full ride and we got our pictures in the paper. And it was just like I had arrived, just like Bill in the book. I had arrived at 16. I'm going away to college. My mom and dad are so proud of their baby girl. But nobody asked me if I wanted to go. I'm a mama's baby. I ain't never been away from home. And I was scared to death. And it's so funny. Coming from South Central, which is considered the ghetto, my mom wanted me to go to UC Berkeley and get friends with white kids and go snowboarding and skiing and just see another part of the world. Unfortunately for her, I went to UC Berkeley and I met the first black girl from Compton. She taught me how to drink, smoke cigarettes, and talk out the side of my neck. My mom was so disappointed. We were on quarter systems, and this was 1980. And when I came home, I was 17, and I'm smoking Virginia Slims, menthols, and talking out the side of my neck. And I remember my mom looking like, what have they done to my baby? So funny. I never drank. I didn't smoke cigarettes, anything. I was at L7 Square going away to UC Berkeley. I had never really kissed a boy. I hadn't had sex. I was just homie. And what happened is that I went away to college and I learned a couple of things. And what I learned to do was drink. The college promoted it. It was drink a hall, drink a floor. You know, I remember losing my scholarship check and me and my roommate thought it was the funniest thing in the world, you know. So I had a good time from 1980 to 1982, going to UC Berkeley, and it was a lot of fun. I didn't think I had an alcohol problem because I didn't lose a house. I didn't lose a car. You know, it was just fun times. I was in college. But what happened was that summer, going into the next year, my second year of college, it was this boy in my neighborhood named Ronnie. Oh, Ronnie was so cute. He had the curly hair. He was so cute. And Ronnie had been chasing me since junior high school. Because remember, I was homie. And I thought Ronnie was in love with Deidre. But what happened, I found out later, I was the only girl in the neighborhood he hadn't had. So I was a challenge. Ronnie didn't love me. I was just a challenge. So what happened was the night before I was going back to UC Berkeley, the night before I was going back, he decides this the night. And so he was over my house and we had a sliding glass door and he told my mom good night, but he had already told me to unlock the sliding glass door so he can come back in. And so he walked around the house and my mom and him went to bed. And so tonight is the night he gonna make me a woman. And so I remember him putting it was record players back then. I don't know if you guys remember that. And it was a record player, and he put on this song called Portuguese Say Love by Tina Marie. And he put that record on to set the mood. And I'll never forget these words. He said, "Deidre, if we do it doggy style, you won't get pregnant." Well, I'm here to tell you that was not true. My daughter is 40 years old and he lied to me. So what happened is we had sex. It was about 5 minutes. If you know Ronnie, I'm sorry. Maybe he got better now, but I didn't know 5 minutes make no baby. So we had sex, and the next day I flew back to UC Berkeley. And about 2-3 months later, I'm getting sick. Me and my roommate think I got stomach flu. And my mom, black moms have a dream about fish when somebody's pregnant. And my mom had a dream, and my sister had a baby. And I flew back home to come see my new nephew. And I threw up in the bathroom, and my mom told my brother, "Go take that girl to take a pregnancy test." And I was like, mom, not me. I'm so innocent, right? And so my brother next to me, he took me down to this clinic. It was a foot clinic, but they did pregnancy tests. So he took me in there. And if they called your name behind the podium, that meant you were pregnant. I remember them calling my full name. And my brother was so excited. He's like, and he had changed his name to Bomani. He was in the black movement. And he was like, "Oh, that's probably another Malcolm X in your stomach." He was all excited. I'm scared to death. Because I had never been pregnant. I'm the baby of the family, so I didn't have no little brothers or sisters to practice on, and I'm about to die. And my brother's all excited. And so I go tell my parents, and I'm telling my mom, you know, "Can I come home from school? Because I don't know nothing about having no baby." And my mom said yes, and my dad said no. And my dad said no because he said he wasn't having no illegitimate grandkids in his house. And my mom looked at him, because my mom really wore the pants in that house. And she said, "Chick," that was my dad's nickname, "Chick, we wasn't married when Ted was born." And I was like, ooh, the first family secret. My oldest brother was older than my mom and dad had been married. So of course I got to come home. My mom helped me with that baby. And guess what? Ronnie, he had moved back with his first baby mama. I didn't even know they do you like that. So here I am coming back home in shame. I'm pregnant. The baby daddy going on with someone else. And I'm resentful. But all I wanted to do was have a baby with good hair. My daughter came out beautiful with curly hair. And that was old news in about 6 months. Because all my friends had went back to college. I'm resentful. I'm stuck with a baby in my mind. I'm stuck with a baby for 1800 years, not 18, you know, just dramatic. And so what happened is I'm starting to go to clubs. I'm 19 now, and I'm starting to go to clubs. I'm not even old enough to get in the clubs, but I'm going and I'm drinking. And the reason I didn't get a DUI is because I didn't even learn how to drive till I was 22. My mom and my sister drove me anywhere I wanted to go. I was spoiled riding. And I remember going to a club with my sister, and she would have one drink all night long called a Rusty Nail. Now, in that same time period, I done had 8 drinks, and I done mixed drinks, and I'm dancing on the table. And it wasn't that kind of club. It was like a quiet supper club, right? And my sister is steady telling me, "Oh, you embarrassing me. You drink too much." And the more she said that, the more I had to drink. And what cured me was one time I was drinking and mixing drinks, and I went home with someone. And I remember waking up the next morning, and I heard this clink, 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 clink in his glass. And this sound like the Alka-Seltzer when you pop it into some water. And I looked over, and it was some dentures in the cup. I said, "Oh Lord, I done went to bed with grandpa." That sobered me up so quick. And that's, you know, that's what's kind of calmed me down for drinking for a minute. And so what happened was me, my mom, and my sister went away to Las Vegas for a fun weekend. My daughter was 3 years old, and we went away for a fun weekend. And on the drive up there, I remember my mom saying, my sister had took the hatchback off the car. And I remember her saying her head hurt. And my sister put the hatchback back on, and we went away for a fun weekend. And so my mom, she loved Las Vegas. And so I had snuck away. I was engaged to somebody, and I snuck away with this guy from work because he was fun. Because he used to take me on lunchtime. He used to take me across from where I worked to this bar downtown, and we would drink at lunchtime. So when I came to AA, and people said, have you ever drank on a job? I'm like, no, I'm not like you people. I didn't know lunchtime counted. I used to get messed up at lunch and drink, and then come back and type my butt off. And what happened is one of the secretaries where I work, I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but she introduced me to this little white powder. And guess what? I could drink, snort that, and not throw up or not have no hangover. And I would type 90 words a minute. So I actually got a promotion on that job. I remember telling my mom, hey, this is what happened at work, and this is what I tried. And my mom knew something about cocaine and alcoholism because she told me to quit that job. But what happened was I had already started putting the stuff in my system. But anyway, back to the story. So I go to Las Vegas with my mom's sister and this guy from work. My mom is pulling the slot machine, laughing. And so me and the guy put the key to the room in her top pocket on her shirt. And I just remember her laughing, and me and him go upstairs to do some non-addictive tooting cocaine and drinking. And I got a call maybe 20 minutes later. Hey, come down this night and your mom's fainting. And so it's hot in Las Vegas. I don't think nothing about it. So I come downstairs, and it's just like a movie. I get out the elevator, and it was a crowd of people. And it looked like they just parted like the Red Sea. And I saw my mom laying on a casino floor. And they were putting those things on her, trying to revive her. And I remember I fell out, and two ladies picked me up, and they said, honey, you're going to have to be strong. And anyway, I remember riding in the ambulance with my mom, and I was yelling, go find my sister. And they were asking me them hard questions, what medicine she on? And I'm the baby. I don't know. And I'm riding, my mom squeezing my hand. And I remember we got to the hospital, and I guess my sister had called everybody in the family, and everybody got to the hospital, and we're surrounding her bed. And it was a pastor that came down, and we were praying real, real hard. And I'm telling you, it was the first time in my life I had prayed out to God. And I said, please don't let my mama die. And I remember praying real, real hard, and my mama died. I was so angry with God, because the first time I ever asked him for something, he didn't make it happen. So anyway, so fast forward, we go home, and the guy that was with me, that's our first date. And my mom dies. And so my dad is like, hey, if he's going to be here, y'all should be married. And the guy looked at me, he said, you want to get married? I said, all right. I didn't really know his last name. And we got married 3 months later in Las Vegas. And we went back to my mom's slot machine, and it was all this hoopla. But really, when I was walking down the aisle, I think we got married at Little Chapel of the Flowers. And I remember looking at my family like, why don't y'all stop this shit? Stop this fiasco. But I'm walking down, and that same brother that had took me for the pregnancy test, he was like, oh, look at my baby sister. And I'm looking like, why don't y'all stop this? And I'm telling you, that wedding was the highlight of the marriage, because he was an addict and I was an alcoholic, and it was a recipe for disaster. And so we got married. We went back to L.A. to start this life. And I remember, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but that he was smoking that stuff called crack. And And I liked to toot cocaine, and he kept telling me I was wasting it. And so we were living together, and he's my husband. So anyway, he finally kept trying to get me to do it the other way, and I finally did it. And oh my God, it was like, beam me up, Scotty. I'd never been had that feeling, and I chased that feeling for about 15 years with alcohol and other things. And I remember we had a house that became the house. So we didn't have no electricity. We didn't have no lights. We didn't have no gas. And my daughter was living there, and I'm trying to maintain some sort of stability. But one time my sister and my brother came over, and I remember my daughter, we had a lot of crackheads living in the house. And my daughter called one of them Uncle Curly, and my sister went berserk. She took my daughter that day. I think my daughter was 4 years old. And when she took my daughter that day, my life went to the curb that night. It was like, at least with my daughter there, I was trying to still go to work and pay child care. But when she was taken from me, my life went to the toilet. And I wasn't just on the curb. I was below the curb, you know. And what happened after that is that they shot up the house, and my husband's mom put us up in a hotel room for a month to get our lives together. And somewhere along the way, he disappeared. For a long time, I didn't know what happened. And I was left with a habit. So now I'm out doing public relations on Figueroa. What that means, if you're from California, that is the whole stroll. So I'm out there, this straight A student that got a full ride to UC Berkeley at 16, I'm out prostituting. And I wasn't a good prostitute, I'll say that. I was not good. I couldn't distinguish an undercover cop from a trick. And so I went to jail 7 times from 1987 to 1990. I went to jail 6 times in my name and 1 time in my sister's name. So don't be alarmed. You know, don't think anything about it. I've made amends to her, and I got her whole record expunged. So don't trip. I made amends. And my thought process at the time was that I had got arrested twice in 1 week. I still had the Sybil brand tag on my arm when I got rearrested. And I said, oh, Lord, they're going to give me a lot of time. So I tried to take the tag off, me and a girl in the back of the car. We burnt it off. And I remember when they asked me my name, I gave my sister name, you know, and her birthday. And so for a long time, she had a whole case she didn't know about. But 1987 to 1990 are really the dark years. A lot of stuff I don't remember. It was a guy killing prostitutes on Figueroa called the Southside Slayer. I remember being at the bus stop on 79th and Figueroa, because I'm pretending I'm catching a bus because I'm not really hauling, but I am. And I'm jumping in and out of cars, and the police stopped me, and they showed me pictures of some of the girls he had killed. And they were trying to save my life. And they were telling me, I believe they told me the guy was picking up girls in a red car. And so the best I could do with my alcoholic thinking was just not getting the red car. I found out later when I went to the military, I'm colorblind. So I got in a maroon car, and I get in the car, and I'm looking at him, and he's looking at me, and I'm thinking, I hope he's not the killer. But I get in the car anyway. I was incapable, once I took a drink, to stop. That drink took a drink, and I was off and running. I wouldn't know how I was going to stop unless I got knocked out, I got arrested, or, you know, something bad had to happen. And so for those dark years, you know, I got raped a lot of times. I got put in incomprehensible, demoralizing situations that I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy, but I could not stop. So from from 87 to 1997, I kept trying to get sober. My family tried to get me sober the first time. They put me in some program called Bricks Kick. It ain't even around today. And everybody in that program was a convict but me. And they were feeding us beans and water, and they would put you in the hot seat and say, bitch, you ain't shit. And I was like, I stayed 2 weeks too long in that program. But later on, I went to different programs. I would tell them how to get me sober. They would tell me I have to double scrub and clean the walls. And I would tell them, you need to teach me the big book. I ain't no maid. And they would put me out the program. So I was probably in about 7 or 8 programs. And what happened in 1988 is that I had a defaulted loan from UC Berkeley. Because when I left school, I took all the scholarship money and all the financial aid money, and I bought all the stuff for my daughter because the baby daddy wasn't no help. He had went back to his first baby mama. And so I didn't know I had to pay that money back. Nobody told me I had to pay that money back. And so I had a defaulted loan. So I was sitting in the AA meeting. I had 6 months of sobriety. And I said, the only way I'm going to get my life together is I need to go back to school. I'm going to go back to school and get my life together. So I was at home looking at TV, and I saw that commercial, be all you can be. Go to the Army. Get the GI Bill. And I said, that's what I'm going to do. And I remember telling an old timer at 9604, I'm going to the Army and get my life together. And he said, honey, what I know about you, I don't think that's going to be a good deal for you because you have a hard time with people telling you what to do. You know what I heard? I heard, that's not what he said, but what I heard in my alcoholic mind, he don't want to see me succeed. Let me show him. And I remember flying out April Fool's Day, 1988, and I'm going to be all you can be, but nobody told me the physical aspect of the Army. I had scored real high because I'm real smart, but nobody told me all that physical stuff. I flew to Fort Dix, New Jersey, and I saw people riding on this rope, gliding across like Tarzan. And I'm like, they want me to do what? Push-up. They said, private, give me 10 push-ups. And I went straight to the floor, and they said, fitness company for her. So I flew in April Fool's Day, 1988, to the U.S. Army. And by April 22nd, they were processing me out of the Army. And this is why. When I was in the Army, we would be marching in the snow, and they would, somebody be off step, and they say, private, get down and give me 20. And I'm looking like I was on step. You better tell that person to give you 20. I ain't giving you shit. So it was called insubordination. And when I went, I was there about 5 days, and they had me go get the new recruits. And they had an amnesty box in, so you had to put your Newports and cigarettes. So the girl looked at me, I looked at her, and we both grabbed a pack of cigarettes. And I'm selling cigarettes, $2 a whop, you know, sliding them across in the chow hall. And I think I'm getting away with all this. And they had all this documented. So when they told me, they got up in my face and said, you are not Army material. I'm like, I know, I'm just here for the GI Bill. They politely processed me right on out. And I didn't know that God orders my steps. Because 30 years later, I work at the Department of Veteran Affairs. And I got a honorable discharge. Had I got a dishonorable, I would not be able to have the job I have today. But that just shows you how God orders my steps. And also, when I was out there, and that guy was killing girls on Figueroa, I would just get that intuition. I'd jump in a car with somebody I don't know, a stranger. And I would get this feeling like, ooh, something ain't right with this guy. And I would say, hey, honey, can you stop right here? Let me get me a pack of cigarettes. And I'd jump out the car, and they never see me again because I just got this icky feeling about this person. And so I just think God protected me when I was out there, so that I could stay sober, get sober, stay sober, and be able to share this with someone younger than me, someone out there on the streets that think their life is over because they've been prostituting or they've been doing incomprehensible, demoralizing things, and to know that you can recreate your life through the 12 steps in God. Because like I said, from 1987 to 97, I struggled. I went to the service to try to get this thing. I went back and forth through the program. I went to at least 10 treatment centers. In September of 1988, I was out doing public relations on Figueroa. And that particular day, I didn't want to do what I promised to do. And so when it was time to pay up, I didn't do it. And I remember jumping out the car. I don't remember if I had my top on and no bottoms or the bottoms on and no top. And the man chasing me with a knife. And I ran through 9604. People used to say, was the meeting going on? I don't know. I was running for my life. And I ran to the back kitchen. And it was an old timer named Clarice that worked in the kitchen. And she said, honey, are you ready to get sober now? And I'm like, yeah, the man chasing me with a knife. I'm ready to go to any lengths to get sober. And they 12-stepped me in that kitchen to a program called ACW. Never heard of that program before. And so I went over to that program. I hadn't ate in a couple of days. And I remember that house mother gave me a hug and said, honey, you want to eat? And I just fell into her arms, dirty, funky, and nasty. And I remember I went to that program, and it happened to be a program geared towards gay women, lesbians. And so I go in that program, and I'm like straight from the streets. I'm like, how come my man can't come to this program? Like I even had a man. And I said, how come only women can come? And I was just balking at everything. And so what happened was if after I had been there a couple of days, you know, I like to adapt to my situation. So after a while, you know, it was a lot of gay girls that dressed like men. And so I was like, oh, my God, you know, she started looking like he, and every meeting was a gay women's meeting and every dance was a gay woman's dance. And so about a week into the program, I'm dancing with her and she fit, you know, she looked like him. And we slow danced and I was like, oh, this is nice. And so they told me you can have sex and not get pregnant. I'm like, sign me up. I want to be gay. And what happened is that I went into that program not knowing I was pregnant. So that meant I had to get pregnant on the street. So my second son is quote unquote a trick baby. And those girls said, that's your baby and God's baby. And I went through that program and I remember having my son. And by this time I done got a girlfriend. And so we live in life and I'm like, ooh, I can have sex and not get pregnant. Sign me up. And I'm with this girlfriend for about 2 years. And what happens is that every couple of years I have a dick attack, right? I want to be with a man. And so I have a girlfriend and I, you know, go out and step out on her and I come up pregnant. So it's like when you have a girlfriend, you ain't supposed to come up pregnant. So I was like, damn, Didi, you can't even do gay right. You will mess up a wet dream. And so here I am pregnant with a girlfriend. And so people used to ask me, so Didi, are you gay? Are you straight? Are you bi? I said, you know what? I'm just greedy. Whatever makes me feel good, I do it. So I don't label myself. I've had girlfriends. I had boyfriends, you know. I'm just grateful that I'm sober and living a different lifestyle today. So now I have 3 kids and I'm still struggling trying to get sober. So the last program I go to was in October 3rd, 1995. What happens is that my dad is dying of prostate cancer and I'm pregnant with my last child. And I was on this magazine crew selling magazines across the country. My sister called me and said, hey, you need to come home. Daddy's dying. And so I came, I think I was like 6 months. And what happened is my dad didn't die and I got stuck back in L.A. My sister was real mean because she had custody of my two daughters. And she didn't have custody. She had my two daughters. It was a family thing. It wasn't through the courts. And here I am pregnant again. And I'm telling her, hey, can you write the paper so I can get on the county? And she's like, nah, you shouldn't be pregnant again. So I was real resentful with her. My dad's dying of cancer. He done went from 200 and something pounds to 112 pounds. And I'm just not dealing with it because the whole time I was on that magazine crew, I was hitting and missing meetings in different states. What happened is when I was about 8 months pregnant, I remember seeing the people across the street from where my daddy lived. I saw him with the hands balled up. And, you know, that was the drug and alcohol house right across the street. And I used to watch him every day. And I remember thinking they're having fun. And here I am, you know, going to be stuck with another child. And what happened is that someone, they wouldn't sell to me because I was poking out pregnant. And I would get people to go around there and get me stuff. And I remember when I gave birth, when I went into labor with my last child, I knew I was in labor. This is my fourth kid. And I know I'm in labor, but I still got $20 in my pocket and I cannot stop, even though I'm in labor. And I remember them rushing me to the hospital and I was trying not to go. I said, oh, Lord, they're going to take me to jail. No concern for the baby at the time because I can't see him. But when that baby came out and he shook, that shook me into recovery. I remember being so embarrassed and so shameful. And I remember nobody knew I had been getting loaded the last 2 months of that pregnancy. And my sister said, what's that tag? What's that toe tag? And I couldn't be honest. I said, oh, he got leukemia. I couldn't tell them they were testing him for drugs and alcohol. And so they took my baby at the hospital. I remember wanting to call the police on the police. How can you just take my child? And so what happened is they wouldn't let me alone with the baby. I had to get escorted every time to go visit him. And the social worker came and took custody of him from the hospital. And so that's what forced me to go into recovery for the last time. I went to a program in Long Beach that allowed you to recover with your child. And what happened was that my counselor was a heroin addict and she had 2 years and I had had 2 years, but I relapsed. And so she couldn't tell me nothing. I remember being very resistant to whatever she wanted. So she blocked my baby from coming into that program. And I remember leaving that program angry and I went to an outpatient and I had to pee in a cup for 18 months. To get my son back. And I remembered it was more like, I love my son, but it was more like, I'm going to show them. And I peed in that cup for 18 months and I got custody of my son back and I went back to my daddy house. And that's where the dope house and alcohol house was across the street. And I remember thinking they're having fun and I'm not in. I went and got loaded again after 18 months of peeing in a cup. And I remember I tested dirty and they told me to turn my baby in back to DCFS. And I was thinking, catch me if you can. And I started panhandling with my son out on the streets. And I remember I was panhandling on 108th in Vermont and I met a pastor. I didn't know he was a pastor, but he didn't give me any money, but he bought me and my son a fish dinner and told me to come down to his church. My life would never be the same. It was a storefront church, and I went to that church, and the whole congregation was about 25 people. They prayed over me and my son. They had me put my Newports on the cross, and I remember they did a collection and gave me the money so me and my son could have a motel room for the night. And I remember getting good and loaded with that church money. And I felt so convicted. I went back the next night to tell them what I did. And this time they prayed over me. And this time when they gave me the money, I went and got a motel room. And I was in that motel room, and it was people around me getting loaded. And I remember I did the simple prayer, God, please help me. And God took the taste of alcohol and drugs out of my mouth that day, October 3rd, 1997. That day I always remember, because I used to hear people say they got struck sober, and I was like, they lying, because it hadn't happened to me. But I believe God knows the desires of my heart, and he knew that I was done. Stick a fork in me, I'm done. He struck me sober that day. I have not found it necessary to go drink and use. I haven't even desired to drink and use since October 3rd. 1997. I don't know why that day, when God took the taste of alcohol and drugs out of my mouth that day, I haven't had a problem staying sober. Whereas from 1987 to 97, I struggled trying to get this thing. And what happened for me is that I had two kids in foster care, and I had two kids. My sister, I used to tell that lie that my sister stole my kids. She didn't steal my kids. I was drinking and using. That was more important. And so here I am trying to get sober, and I'm trying to, I don't know how coming to a meeting and telling people my business was going to change my life. But I remember I didn't believe in God. I didn't know he had the power, because when I prayed real hard for my mama not to die, she died. So I struggled with that third step, turn your will and your life over to the care of God. And I just used the group, a group of drunks, as my higher power for about the first 3-4 years. And I remember God started showing up and showing out. I ended up going back to school. I went through a special program, and I was able to get financial aid, and I went back to school and got my bachelor's degree. And I was gonna go on to get my master's, my PhD. Y'all was gonna call me doctor. But what happened is, after I got my bachelor's degree and my kids were a little older, I was telling my sponsor something, and she said, why don't you go get a damn job? I'm tired of paying taxes for people like you, people who can work. And I, just to get her off my back, I went to this job fair at Cal State Dominguez, and it was the Department of Veteran Affairs. And they said they were hiring people with a GPA of 3.5 or better. President Obama had a special program. So I got hired. We were on a 2-year probation. And what happened was, I was on the podium. Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, God, for this opportunity. And 2 weeks later, they had us do the background. And I remember they called me in the office, and my heart dropped. I said, oh, Lord, they done found out I'm a hoe, right? And I go in there, and what happened was my fingerprints had smeared. And what happened, I had to re-fingerprint. And by the time I went home, the expungement had came in the mail saying that my record was expunged. It had been granted. So the next time they called me in the office at the Department of Veteran Affairs, it was to get a promotion. And I just looked up and I said, God, you show is funny. You know, I was able to, I've been there over 15 years. I went back to school, got my bachelor's, got my master's degree. And just recently, because I believe if you're a blessing, then God gives you a blessing. I've been at the VA for over 15 years, and I did that public forgiveness loan, and I had $108,000 in student loan debt. I got the letter 2 weeks ago telling me my debt had been forgiven. They wiped out $108,000 worth of debt. It was like a gorilla was off my back. And then the other thing was, 3 days later, I got money in the mail from student loan refund, over $2,000. So not only did they wipe out my debt, but they gave me money back. I had a son when I was at that gay program, ACW. What happened was, I had my son for 5 months after I gave birth to him. I was in a sober living. And what happened is, I stopped taking care of my son. I wouldn't get out the bed, but the girls in the sober living, they started taking care of him, changing his diaper, and nobody knew how to help me because it wasn't AA related. What happened was, I drank furniture polish and overdosed on iron pills, and they took me 5150 to the hospital. My son was gone with the other girls in the house to the movie. So when they came, when he came back, they rushed him to the hospital and they took my son and said I was a danger to him and to myself because I attempted suicide. What I was going through was postpartum depression. Because it wasn't AA related, nobody knew how to help me. So my sister got my first cousin to get custody of my son when he was 5 months. They had him for 16 years and they didn't want him to know I was his mom. So he just thought I was some nice lady, bought him stuff, you know, for his birthday and Christmas. So when he was 16, my cousin remarried and him and the new wife didn't get along. And my son ran away from long-term foster care. So I had got granted custody of my younger son back. And I was the same courtroom, same public defender, same judge. And they were like, what you doing back in here, Miss Knighton? I said, oh, my older son, you know, he was in foster care. And I came to see what would happen to him. And so before you knew it, they asked my son, do you want to go back to foster care or do you want to go with your mom? And he said, I'll go with her. He wouldn't even call me mom. He called me her. And they hit the gavel and I'm taking home this stranger. He's 16, but we didn't have a relationship. And so I'm trying to play mama after 16 years and he not having it. I remember him telling me, you ain't my mama. You just the lady that gave birth to me. And it was like a knife in my chest. And if any moms are out there, you know the feeling. And it was the wreckage of my past. It wasn't nothing I could do but go forward. And so thank God they mandated us to counseling. And we did mandated counseling once a week for a year. By the end of the year, that baby was saying, this is my mama. I love her. And it changed the whole relationship. Today, my son is 33. And I told him, I cannot go back and recreate those 16 years, but I will be here for you from now and we can build a new relationship. And he's one of my best friends. And guess what? He works for Delta Airlines. I made amends to him. Guess who gets to fly free, ladies? So I'm not saying that's why you should do a nice step amends, but I'm just saying it worked out for me. And then, my oldest daughter, I never got to raise her. She stayed with my sister the whole time. And when she got pregnant, she asked, could she come live with me and not work so that she could bond with her son? And I was so excited. She came to live with me and I got to be with my son, with all my kids and my grandson. And you know what? We had a bad argument and she ended up moving back with my sister. But we have, you know, I've made amends to her. And today, like my two grandsons, I think God gives us a redo with the grandkids. I was not the best mother. I put drugs and alcohol in front of my kids. But I'm telling you that shame and guilt has been relieved. I've made amends to them. I do living amends. And I'm the best grandma that I can be. Those two grandsons, one is 16 and one is 5, they think I'm the best thing since sliced bread. When that little one puts his arms around my neck and says, Grandma, I love you. You can knock me over with a feather. I am so grateful. And those two grandsons, I started college funds for them because I don't want them to have student loan debt. And I took them to Orlando, Florida, to Disney World and Animal Kingdom, and we had the time of our lives. And it was all on Grandma's dime. And today, I tell you, I used to share with my head down. I could not look people in the eye. Today, baby, I am Black and beautiful. I'm 60 and Black don't crack. I look 40. You can't tell I'm 60. And I have 25 years of wisdom on experience, strength, and hope. And when women come to me beaten down or domestic violence and they so ashamed of their story, I make them do affirmations. I let them do the 12 steps and I let them come into their own so that they can look the world across the eye and be proud of who they've become. Because today, you can't tell me nothing. You can't call me no crackhead. You can't call me nothing but Miss Knighton, Deidre Knighton. And I'm not afraid to say my full name because I am proud of what God has recreated. I think God, a friend of mine, Teresa, always says, I think God is a show off. He takes a wretch like me. He dusts me off and cleans me up to show you how awesome he is. Nobody at my job would ever believe the stories that I have. And I'll tell you one. They say secrets keep us sick. So I'm going to tell y'all this story that I was going to take to the grave. So I was out there doing, you know, public relations. And this guy offered me $100 for a picture. I'm like, $100? You know, I had to work real hard to get $100. So I'm like, okay, bet. So he told me, you know, he gave me the money and I got good and loaded with the money. And then he said, okay, it's time to pay up. So I'm posing for a Polaroid picture. And this man started taking out the tripod and the lights and the camera and motion picture. He talking about motion picture movies. I'm like, oh my Lord. So he got me in a motel room and he told me to do this, do that. And it's so funny. I don't look back then like I look now. So when I started dating in the program and people said, okay, babe, you want to get a porno movie? I'm like, oh no. Like I'm such a prude. I'm not into that. I'm scared that I'm on the damn movie, right? I'm going coast to coast. So that was the secret I was going to take to the grave. So if you ever saw a porno movie and you thought that was me, wasn't me. Like Shaggy, wasn't me. So that was the secret I was going to take to the grave. And today, that sister, we had fist fights about my kids. When I got custody of my daughter's back, I snatched them from her. I didn't care about her feelings at the time. And so I had to pay a spiritual price for that. But I'm glad I took my youngest daughter so she was able to be raised with her brothers. And I had to make amends to my sisters for how I treated her, because I didn't know that once you have somebody kids for a while, you get attached. So when I went and snatched my kids back from her, she was devastated. So the one thing is that we weren't even speaking, and my sister got breast cancer, and we weren't even speaking at the time. And I went to the hospital not knowing how she would receive me. And when she opened her eyes, she said, I'm glad you're here. I love you. And that was the start of us rebuilding our relationship. Today, we are good sisters. We're going to the Soul Train cruise next year. And either we're going to be in a room together, we're going to kill each other, or we're going to be best friends. But the fact is, for the last 25 years, she has never missed me taking a cake. She's proud of me. My brothers and the whole family is proud of me. And my brother, he said, you pulled yourself up by the bootstraps. I've never known anybody to do what you've done. But that wasn't me. That was God in the 12 steps of recovery. And today, I'm sponsored. I sponsor women, and my sponsees sponsor women. And we just have a good time together. We do girls trips. We do conventions. And anywhere, anytime the hand of AA reaches out, I want to be the hand to grab that woman. I love the men, but I believe us women, we really suffer emotionally and sexually in this thing. And today, I am the best me I could be. And I was recently diagnosed with PTSD. And it comes from all the rapes and the kidnappings and all the stuff that happened to me on the streets. But you know what? It just lets me know that I can recover, because I stuffed that stuff down so far that it's just now surfacing at 25 years. And I'm so grateful that I don't have to take medication, but I'm doing, you know, trauma therapy, and I'm getting through it. And once I get through it, I'll be able to help another woman get through it. And that's the thing. One alcoholic helping another. That is the claim to fame. That's what keeps me waking up in the morning. And I'm telling you, life is good. I wouldn't change a thing. If I had it to do over, I would do everything because it makes me who I am today. And let me tell you my favorite poem. An old timer put this on a card and gave to me, and I always keep it in my wallet. But it lets you understand about God. And so this is the poem, and I want to end with this. As children bring their broken toys with tears for us to mend, I brought my broken dreams to God because he was my friend. But then instead of leaving him in peace to work alone, I hung around and tried to help with ways that were my own. At last, I snatched them back and cried, "How could you be so slow? My child," God said, "what could I do? You never did let go." God is good all the time, no exceptions. Thanks for letting me share my story with you. And God is good all the time, no exceptions. Deidre K., Alcoholic. Thanks for letting me share my story.
Thank you for your story. Every part of me was with you the entire time. And your storytelling and your humor and, oh my goodness, fantastic. I don't know how I can add any value by asking questions. So I don't know how many I have. I know for sure I have one and we'll go from there. Do you have more time?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you had mentioned at the end there about PTSD recently being diagnosed. Do you mind telling us how it presented itself in your life and behavior?
Okay. So maybe it was 6 months ago. Could have been a little longer. There was a shooting of some young kids in Texas. And my grandson lives in Texas. So when that shooting happened, I reacted to it and I just started crying and I was at work. And for some reason, my supervisor hit me up on Microsoft Teams and he said, "Are you okay?" I don't know why. And I told him, "No." I said, "I reacted to the shooting in Texas, to those kids that got killed. Can you hook me up with EAP, Employee Assistance Program?" And they hooked me up with a therapist. And I shared with her what was going on. I shared with her some of my, you know, my alcoholism and stuff that happened to me. And she said, "Miss, you know, Deidre, I believe you're suffering from and I had a panic attack on the freeway. And I never had one in my whole life. And so she said, "I believe you're suffering from PTSD because of the things that happened to you in your past. You know, I was brutally raped a lot of times, you know." And so I just stuffed that stuff down so far. And so it just seems like, you know how they say more will be revealed. Mm-hmm. It's just starting to come out. 25 years sober is starting to come out. And like you say, I make humor of some of the things that happened to me, but that stuff was not funny. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so this lady is just helping me so much with doing the trauma therapy and getting to the bottom of, we finding out that I had anxiety all my life. And what happened is that people like me, we drink and use on top of it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. To ease it. And so, yeah, I'm just, more is being revealed. So I'm working more with newcomers. I'm working more with my sponsor to get to the other side. I hope that answers the
question. It does. It absolutely does. And I think that's just another example. I don't think, I know. This is another example of what we're taught in the rooms, and that's to access the tools that are available to us and then do the work. And it sounds like you, I know there's this EAP thing. I've been around this job for a while. Yes, you can help. Mm-hmm. You know, someone offers help. "No, I'm fine. I got it. It's just a bad day." Or instead you asked for help. And it's not just a one-time asking for help. You're an example of, in 25 years in, I still have to ask for help. There's still growth right to be done. There's still healing to be done. It doesn't take away the beauty of sobriety. It's just life happens.
Right. Exactly. And also my kids know my story. They're not ashamed that I used to be a prostitute, you know, they're like, you're awesome, Mom. So a lot of times with all the stuff I've been through, people always say, you need to write a book. And I was like, oh, my kid is still living. I can't write a book. But they always say, yes, you can.
Yes, you
I'm like, well, Beyonce will have to play me in the movie.
That's right. That's right.
But yeah, so.
Yeah. Yeah, you should write a book. You had mentioned having to pay a spiritual price after you took your daughters from your sister.
Right.
Was there something specific you were referring to when you said that?
Things happened when I did that. And I believe I paid a spiritual price for not considering her feelings. I didn't wait for God to tell me how to do it. I just snatched my kid. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I didn't consider my sister's feelings. And I suffered for a couple of months behind that, spiritually. Nothing good was happening for me. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think that the opposite is true when we listen to guidance and give to others that we... Actually, I know that you think this. Wait a minute. What did you say? Hold on. You had a beautiful quote about if you're a blessing, God... What is it? I didn't write it all down. If you're a blessing, God gives you a blessing.
Right. Once you give a blessing, God, you receive a blessing. I forgot how I say it. But the other thing that we always say is don't let your life that AA gave you get in the way of your AA life. And a lot of people do that. They get all these blessings and then they stop coming to the meetings.
You mentioned God ordering your steps. Did I catch that right? God orders my steps?
Mm-hmm.
So tell me more what you mean by that.
So I do prayer meditation. I struggle with the meditation part, but I do a lot of prayers. And when I ask God to please order my steps, don't let me be in control of what I'm doing. Let him do it. No way did I know back in 1988, that if I would have got a dishonorable discharge, I wouldn't have the job I have today. He ordered that long. He knew to let me out of the service with a honorable discharge, process me in and out, that 30 years later, I was going to work at the VA. You know what I mean? It just, he ordered me to do the bachelor's degree and get my master's degree. The promotion I got on my job, I beat the other girl out because I had a master's degree and she only had a bachelor's. Stuff like that. When I was on food stamps in Section 8 and I got the job at the VA. 6 months later, I take my food stamps and my check stub and my worker says, Miss Knight, you know you cut off. You make more money than me. He ordered, you know, I got the degree. That's how I got the job. I had a 3.5 or better. That's how I got hired at the VA. And then I go from food stamps, Section 8, you know, paying $400 a month, paying $400 a month for rent. So now I'm a homeowner paying over $2,300 a month for a house. I'm a homeowner. I went from a hoe to a homeowner. That's usually what I say in my pitch. I forgot to say it.
Well, we're still recording, so you didn't totally
forget. Okay. So I went from being a hoe to a homeowner. You know, that God had to make that happen. You know what I mean?
God is a show-off.
He's a show-off. He takes a wretch like me and does all this. And I believe I give back. I do 3-4 meetings a week. I meet with my sponsees. We have a Zoom meeting. You know, we check in. We're doing the 12 traditions as a group. And my sponsees, once I take them through the 12 steps, they must get a sponsee. They must give back what was so freely given.
Well, I love hearing all of that. I appreciate you sharing how much you're still giving to the program. Is there anything in your story or anything that you'd like to share that maybe you left out or is popping in your head now?
Just, I don't know, like when I was I don't know. I guess the big thing was the thing with my son that, you know, how he was so resistant with me pushing to become mom, and that I had to, they told me to go to parenting. I had four kids and they told me to go to parenting. And I was thinking, ain't no way in heck I need parenting classes. And I needed them bad. And the counselor showed me how to have home meetings, have the kids work together, have them learn to respect me as the mom and not as the recovering alcoholic. Just stuff I learned. And it was stuff like one of the counselors that was over my son in the foster care system. He was still in foster care before they granted me custody of him back. And she was telling him, oh, you should stay in foster care. They'll pay for your college for free. And
what?
Come listen. And so I got her kicked off the case. One of my counselors in one of those programs, I went to see her. She had relapsed and she was back in the program. I went to see her take her tape. Now I got more time than her. And it was a newcomer stood up and said she thinks she has a problem. It ends up being my son's foster care social worker. And when I went to hug her as a newcomer, she said, I know you. You got me kicked off your son's case. Can you believe?
Wow.
And so what happened is her mama never got her back. Her mama didn't get her back. So she had to go through the foster care system. My son, I got him through EOP program. I got him into college. And because I won all the scholarships, they offered him scholarships because I was real popular at my Cal State Dominguez. And he graduated from college, not through the foster care program, but because we reunited but left up to her, she was trying to make him her story. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Your mama didn't get you back. His mama got him back. And so I had to fight the system to get her kicked off the case. And then come to find out she one of us. You know what I mean? How crazy is that? I have stories like that. Like, wow. God sure is funny.
I mean, it sounds like a movie. It sounds like a book that's going to turn into a movie for sure. It is a beautiful story of redemption, which is how you started your story.
And you know what? A lot of people don't have my story. They got kids that don't talk to them.
Yeah.
Kids that don't, they never forgive them. And I'm just so grateful that's not mine. You know? It still hurts, but I've forgiven myself. I'll say that. It took years.
Well, I'm glad that you forgave yourself because now you're a valuable contribution to other people's lives.
Thank you.
And you couldn't have done that if you didn't forgive yourself.
So I'm curious to how this is going to turn out.
Well, I got one more final question and then you're off the hook.
Okay.
Final question. For the alcoholic out there listening, what message would you like to leave with them?
That AA works. Just have an open mind. That's all you have to. You don't have to believe anything. Just have an open mind and know what you're doing isn't working. So try something. Have an open mind. And if you don't believe in God, it's okay. Use the group. Use the group of drunks, G-O-D. Because I had to use that for at least 3-4 years before I got my own conception of God.
What about the alcoholic who has years under their belt and they are full of anxiety or suffering? What message do you have for them?
That the book tells us we can seek outside help. That for me, I had grave emotional and mental disorders. I had to go outside and get outside help. And that those people a lot of times are one of us. So they really, if you get a therapist that is also in recovery, you're a double winner because it just works. They understand. They understand. So that's what works for me. I went and got outside help.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.